The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
So the publisher can demand, you know, I want to see this feature. EA demands that this game work with Origin. Ubisoft demands that Uplay? Is that what? That their universal sign-up system gets added on. Things like that, right? That happens all the time. Other stuff that's maybe money-related or market-related? Sometimes expectations just, oh, sorry, yeah.
This feature tends to sell really well, so you should add this to every...
Yeah, that usually is similar to the publisher thing. Someone's got to push that. But it could come internally from the development team, right? They look at competing products and says, hey, this thing seems to be doing well. Let's add hats, because hats seem to be doing well for some games. So, you know, we can add hats to our game. It's not going to necessarily change the way how the game functions, but it's still a new feature. It's still a new, you still got to come up with mechanics to unlock new hats and equip new hats and make sure they animate correctly and things like that, even if necessarily the gameplay decision making you make in the game doesn't change. And of course, hats actually do change the way how some games work. The changes in marketplace in general. And sometimes they're making a sequel to a game, right? Sometimes you're adding number two or number three at the end of the title, and your players are going to expect something new. And so there's some pressure for you to sort of add new mechanics instead of simply, say, iterating on the old ones. Why would you cut mechanics? Not necessarily cutting features, but cutting mechanics, game mechanics. That's one good reason I've been drilling into you all semester long. Yeah.
Simplify gameplay. So what makes it easier to learn?
Decreased learning curve is a little bit separate from simplified gameplay. Both good points, right? You know, decreasing learning curve is like testers just don't get how this game functions because too much stuff going on simultaneously. You could try to tune those mechanics to make it a little bit more legible. You could just try taking mechanics completely out so that people can actually learn it. Simplifying the game could be that, but it also could be just trying to make what's core about the game more obvious. You know, this game is really about generations and generations of heroes, you know. There's a game, right? Hero Generations. And you want, you know, and you've got, say, some sort of very elaborate weapons crafting mechanic or something in there. Well, the weapons crafting mechanic may not be really what your game's about. So you might want to take that out because people sort of forget about what the core experience of your game is supposed to be. So focusing back on the core of your game. What else? Say your game...
New technologies.
New technologies come out? Like what, physics? You know, maybe?
Yeah, or kind of new things like... they mentioned that...
Mm-hmm.
3D comes out, it
doesn't
change.
Well, that's true, right? I'm trying to think of a game where that's a really obvious example. Can anyone think of a game mechanic that substantially changed when it went from 2D to 3D? I'm thinking Mario, but...
Movement.
Just plain old movement. Well, the way how the camera responds to movement as well, that's a big one, right? In a 2D game, say a side-scrolling game like Metroid or something like that, you don't have this situation where the place where you're trying to go to is obscured unless it's actually physically blocked by something that you have to destroy or open up or something. But in a 3D space, that happens all the time. You know, you've just got bits of background scenery getting in the way of the camera. Mario just changed the way how jumps work entirely when it went from the 2D Marios to Super Mario 64. And they added, and every iteration on top of that has added new ways to jump, double jumps, triple jumps, jumping off the wall, and stuff like that. Now the latest Mario games expect that you know all of that, which is why I can't play Mario anymore because I didn't go through that process. Although the games are not that hard, at least the first couple of levels are not that hard. Let's see, what else? This one I've been always mentioning this entire semester.
Just to try something.
Just to try something?
Yeah.
Just to see how it's going to change how the gameplay works, right? You know, let's take something out and see whether that was actually essential to the experience, or maybe it was getting in the way of the experience, you don't know. You know, and the emergent results of taking out a mechanic might actually end up as a more interesting experience. One thing that the book does mention is to take stuff out that might actually change the ESRB rating of your game, or the PEGI rating if you're selling something in the UK or in Europe. So for instance, if you're building on top of a game engine like Unreal or something like that, which has body location damage, you know, you shoot a head, you know, the game knows that you shot the head. But maybe you don't want your game to be that specific. Maybe you're designing a game for kids or something like that, and it's like, well, rewarding kids for successfully headshotting each other is maybe not the field that we want to go for. It might actually push us into out of the E for everyone and into the what's the next rating? T. Yeah, there's like an E10 rating. At least there used to be. Okay. And sometimes you just gotta cut mechanics because you don't have time to do them. They're great ideas. They will actually make your game better if you had time to be able to polish them and make them understandable and smooth and everything. You just run out of time, and you just want to be able to ship. So that's a perfectly legitimate consideration. So that's this process of like generating ideas. Say this is like an axis of like the number of ideas that you've got in your game and mechanics in terms of either rules in a computer game, it'll be code. In these games, let's just say it's rules, it's pieces, it's boards, it's everything that you actually have to make your game work. And you kind of go through this brainstorming phase where you get like a ton of ideas, right? You got some good ones up here, got some crappy ones down there. Which is probably more like you got a whole bunch of crappy ideas, and you got a couple of good ideas. But you get this big explosion of ideas where ideas turn into experiments. Some of them are thought experiments that you're thinking, you know, just discussing them among your team. What if we did this? What if we did that? How would you solve that problem? They may be real testable experiments where you're it's something that you can play, you know, something that you whip up within an hour or half an hour, and you actually put it in front. We've been doing that all semester. Some of the ideas may just come up of, you know, different ideas interacting. And it says, what if we had, you know, dogs in our game? What if we had solar power in game? What if we had solar powered dogs in our game? And things like that. You know, and then ideas just happen. However, it's important, you know, So far, I'm sort of been describing the brainstorming process that you've all been through already. But one thing that we haven't necessarily asked you to do nearly as much is to come up with actual discrete experiments. You know, it's like, here's an idea, actually come up with a criteria of success that you're looking for. How do we know whether this particular idea, this particular experiment version of the idea is succeeding or not? And you're going to need that because you're going to need to cull. You're going to need to like reduce this back down, try to keep this, or maybe even build this up a little bit. Actually, it's probably more like you're going to cull a little bit. Then you want to bring this up again. And then each time this goes, you have kind of an increase in bad ideas. You have an increase in bad ideas, but a decrease of bad ideas. But your total number of good ideas just keep going up, right? And by good, I'm using a very vague term. It could mean polished. It could mean actually good for gameplay. It could mean, you know, something that's been proven in the marketplace. Something desirable that you want to keep in your game.
Things that could be, like, it should be good for the core experience, but one of the problems could be they're good working mechanics that actually don't help the core experience or detract from the core experience.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Let's see. There are a couple of dangers even in this early brainstorming process. So I'm just looking at this part here. Well, I guess this whole part here. One is that you pretty much already think you already know what game you're gonna make. You've got a single solution, you know, say you're taking the computer game version of this class and you decide that you're going to make an RPG and your model is Final Fantasy VI. Okay, so everything is going to basically follow the Final Fantasy VI template. So you're basically pursuing one single solution. And the problem with that is that your implementation ability of actually making all of those things fit that template is already not, you are not Square, right? You don't have all of the resources that Square had, even back when Final Fantasy VI came out. How old is Final Fantasy VI? 1994? Two? Something like that. I mean, even then, they were a large team with many years to work at least a year to work on that game. I don't know how long they actually worked on that game. There's a very, very good chance that your ability to actually even implement something that you know how it already works may not be able to meet that. So you will have a failed experiment, and then you're kind of stuck. You don't know what to do. So you're going to have to do lots and lots of experiments. But experiments are expensive. Everything takes time. Everything is going to need culling at some point in time, and which means a certain amount of time that isn't going to end up going into making this chunk. Actually went into this chunk. Which is why we've been trying to teach you how to prototype really, really quickly. It's a little bit of a recap, because we want you to try to be able to get onto experiments, come to a conclusion about whether that idea was good or not, as fast as possible, so that you kind of reduce the cost of doing a single experiment. And yeah, it's true that you're not going to be able to conduct an experiment on every single idea that you've got. So you have to kind of pick and choose select number of ideas to be able to take to experimental stage. Now, there are a couple of things that you can look out for to say maybe we don't want to conduct an experiment on something. One is a brittle idea. And a brittle idea is that you kind of have to kind of twist it really, really, really hard to be able to make it fit with any idea that you've already got. I'm assuming that you've already got a concept that your team was kind of built around this concept. Somebody comes up with an idea, and there's a huge amount of twisting and turning to be able to even make it fit close, even though you think that on its own this idea is a really good idea. You might actually want to see how many different ways could this particular idea be executed before you actually decide on a way on an experiment to conduct on that idea. Two ways that you can do that. One is that you just specify specify what is the goal of this possibly brittle idea, right? It takes a lot of twisting. Why do we need this idea in the first place? Is it because the challenge in the game is too low? Is it because players have too much information or not enough information about what they're supposed to do? Is it because you want to introduce a little element of chance or maybe sort of give some sort of strategic decision making? Try to identify what is this problem that you're trying to solve in the first place with this kind of unwieldy idea. All right, and once you'll be able to identify that, then you come up with, all right, what are all the different ways that we could address that problem, as opposed to here's this one solution that's kind of unwieldy that might very well solve that problem, but maybe there are alternatives. Has anyone encountered this in your own prototyping? Maybe this assignment, maybe in a previous assignment? Like somebody had an idea that was just kind of hard to use, but then what the idea was trying to solve was actually a good problem to solve. No? Not yet? I thought I saw some nuts. If you've encountered it, I'd love to get an example from one of you. I can throw out examples, but I'd love to be able to hear examples from one of you. No? Shh, Yeah.
I guess in our first game, we noticed a couple problems with the game, so we came up with various ways of trying to resolve it that didn't really work for the game itself, but solved the smaller problem.
Yeah, so can you be more specific about what the problem was?
Yeah, I'm trying to think back to specific ones. One of them was that the way our game was with, you know, the set and the tic-tac-toe, it was really hard to see what sets were available on the board.
Right, this was a set assembly game, sure.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so one of the things we tried to do was removing the center tile altogether so that you could only play around the edges, which did solve the problem of now you could really see what everything was. It was a lot easier in that sense, except it was just a lot less interesting of a game because there's a lot less strategy to it.
So you had a version of the game where all the squares were in play, including the center tile, and it just made it confusing for your players.
Yeah.
And then you have a version of the game where it's just like, this one possible solution to this problem is just take the center tile out.
Yeah.
But that made it trivial.
So we tried to find a middle ground, and that's how we ended up with the idea where we had one single card in the middle, because you could still use it, but you didn't have to worry about like the lines of play going through the middle and how incredibly complex it is to try and reason about that.
Okay, so it actually sounds like instead of a brittle idea, you actually had a good robust idea, which is that center square is really problematic. It has possibilities, it has really interesting gameplay possibilities, but for learning the game and starting up the game, it's problematic. And so you found a way to say, all right, how do we deal with this center square instead of the solution of just delete the center square? You know, let's find a different way to work it into the game. And your final game actually does that. Something else that you can do is, you know, if you've got an idea for your game, it's kind of unwieldy, not quite sure what to do about it, discuss it among your team, but don't conduct an experiment on it. Don't work into your rules, don't try to implement it. Just get it into everybody's heads. Because that idea may come bubbling up later, and little bits of it might be applicable and in a slightly easier to implement way as you make progress in your game. So in other words, put it on a back burner, but make sure you have actually had a chance to discuss it so that everyone's, you know, kind of thinking about it, even if it's not something that you've decided that you actually want to do right away. Might be a lot faster to just have a quick discussion in that case than to conduct the experiment. So those are a couple of strategies on, like, how do you sort of focus your experimenting time? And this is probably not going to be very useful for assignment 2, but it is going to be useful for assignment 3. Because in assignment 2, you're well past the creating and adding new features part, and now you're just trying to get this out of the door for Wednesday. So let's talk about this phase now. I'm going to focus on this one instead. The sort of like cutting phase, where you're both cutting good stuff and bad stuff, but you're cutting stuff in general because you have to. Maybe because you're running out of time, maybe because you are trying to get rid of the bad stuff. So things that you need to do, and this is something that I would like you to do today when you meet up in your teams, is to determine what is the criteria which you're going to cut a feature. For instance, come up with a quick description about what your game's supposed to be all about. You may already have written this in your rules. It might be in the very first paragraph of your rules saying that our game is about getting entangled with other people, you know, or pushing them over, for instance. I know that, you know, which is it, you know, and being able to identify. And then when you look at all of your rules in your game, you can actually determine, okay, which chunks of our mechanics actually serve that goal, and which ones don't? You know, there are things that are there just to keep your game going. Those may be fine to keep, but those aren't directly contributing to how good your game is. Those are just basically there to keep the thing working. And maybe they can take a little bit of improvement, but they're kind of suspect. And then there's things that directly contribute to your core gameplay that you're trying to achieve with your game. And those are probably things that you want to spend a lot more time making sure that the rules are absolutely clear, that your players understand what they mean, that, you know, if there's any other mechanics in your game that's supporting that, you know, that's that that those meet your criteria for what should stay in your game. Because once you know what your criteria is, it becomes a lot easier to be able to just look at everything that you've got, deciding what to keep and invest more time in, and what to cut. Now, there's a couple of problems that people typically run into when it comes to cutting stuff out. A couple of game developers refer to this as culling. If you come from 3D graphics, culling is a very common word, just to be able to just cut all the stuff out that you don't need. So, for instance, if you don't have an explicit culling criteria, then you don't actually know. You don't actually know why a certain mechanic exists, and you don't actually know whether you should keep it or not. So that discussion should be something that you happen today. You know, when you, in the end, what is your game about, and does your game actually meet that? The other you might have other culling criteria that aren't that. That are, does this game run in 5 minutes? What was the limit for this one? 10 minutes, I believe.
20.
Oh, it was 20 minutes. Okay, so the game doesn't run. You know, if the game needs to run in 20 minutes because we as instructors gave you that limitation, then that's probably a perfectly reasonable culling criteria for you to use. What in our game is sort of contributing towards this, and what's actually getting in our way of hitting that target? Let's see. Something else that comes in that affects culling, that affects this phase, is when you conduct experiments here, but your experiments are not very tangible. They're kind of floaty and wavy. This usually happens in teams that like to talk out all of their ideas, but don't actually like to do a lot of like hardcore prototyping and playtesting. I hope that's not so much of a problem for anyone in this class by now. You've gotten a lot of practice in that, but you may have a couple of rules or mechanics that have ended up in your game that you never actually prototyped, that you never actually tested out with real people. Make sure that whatever actually ends up in the version that you hand them on Wednesday is something that you've actually tested. It's something that you've actually gotten some real data about whether it's working or not. This one happens with every student project, but game developers in general always assume that adding more stuff is better. It takes a very, very, very seasoned game designer to sort of realize that sometimes simplicity is good. Again, I hope this is not the terribly new revelation to the people in this class, but I see it in student projects all the time. I see it in student projects where they assume that more features and more complexity is going to be better. In fact, I saw some of them in assignment one, and we're going to be talking a little bit about that. More complexity doesn't necessarily always make for a better game. It may make it a more interesting intellectual problem. It doesn't necessarily always make it into a more entertaining game. Let's see. One thing about culling is that cutting features and cutting stuff out kind of takes practice. You've got to do it fairly regularly. For assignment three, which is going to be starting on Wednesday, right? We actually started on Wednesday. What I'm going to ask you to do is try cutting a feature every week. You know, like just say, all right, what's on the chopping block this week? You know, every Monday, or you know, every Wednesday, or if you have a regular meeting time on Saturday or something like that. Just like, what's on the chopping block? What is the least useful thing that we've got in our game right now? And just try that. Because you can always add stuff in later. You can always, remember, this is a cyclical thing. You're going to be adding, then cutting, adding and cutting, adding and cut and cutting. I think you've gotten a lot of practice on the adding part. But you've got to practice a little bit more on the cutting part now. And you've got time to be able to do this for assignment three. You've got a little bit more time on assignment three than you had on assignment two. So start setting yourself like a schedule. All right, we're definitely going to cut something. I don't know what it is, but we're going to meet up as a team and we're going to decide that. And if it turns out that it was the wrong thing to cut, you can add it back later. But that allows you to focus your efforts on the things that you've deemed as more important for a short amount of time. It can be hard to be objective about this process. Something that we've done in mostly our video game development, but you can do this with paper prototypes. So have to hand people very, very simple survey forms that basically say, how fun did you find this? How fun did you find that? You know, say your game has different roles. You know, you have a Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. You know, these are your four roles in your game. You know, and you just hand out the survey form. How fun did you find being a tinker? How fun do you find being a tailor? Just 1, 2, 5. You know, and that isn't terribly much information, but it gives you just enough information to help you concentrate your efforts on what's the most problematic thing in our game right now. You know, you can go into greater details, like, do you think that the game was too long, too short? Too challenging, too easy, too luck-based, you know, required too much thought. You can put these things on these like 5-point scales and it'll be able to give you a little bit of feedback. Doesn't necessarily tell you what the problem is, but it tells you where the problem might lie. And that will help focus your discussions and your efforts a little bit. And finally, the most important thing is that you've got to keep doing this over and over and over again. If you just do this once, you kind of end up in this situation where you've got a bunch of good ideas, but the bad ideas are still there. What you eventually want to get to, I'm going to extend this grid, is what you eventually want to get to is a situation where the only stuff that's left in your game is the stuff that is worth keeping and that works well. And all the stuff that was bad, you've either completely cut it out, you know, or you've improved it to the point where it's actually a desirable feature. And you're only going to be able to get through that through multiple iterations. You're not going to get through that just by introducing something at the last minute and hoping that it works, because you haven't had time to actually improve it and polish it yet. Now, something that's less of a problem for this class, but may be a problem in your other game design experiments outside of class, is that you may not know when to call it a day, right? You know, like you could repeat this process forever. And you've heard about games that have been going on for 4 or 5 years. How long was Duke Nukem Forever in production for? 15? At least 10. And that was actually one example of where new technology just ended up changing the foundation of which that game was built on over and over and over again. They just kept resetting the game engine development and just took forever. One thing that game could probably have used is just some sort of like standard criteria of saying, like, once we hit this criteria, we're shipping this game, right? It could be once we spent X amount of money. That probably shouldn't have been the case for that particular game. But it could have been once our informal internal surveys hit a rating of 4 out of 5, right? You know, that might have been good enough. Some companies don't settle for that. There are companies that say, like, we're only going to release the absolute best game that we absolutely can. But don't kid yourself, internally they do have criteria on when these games have to ship. Even Nintendo does. And Nintendo is notorious for shipping late games, because they have this mantra that a game is late for a short while and a bad game is bad forever. So that's what they say to the public. Internally, they ship by Christmas. They get those games out to the market because they have a time box. That's the other way to do it. And it says, like, well, we have to be able to get into the manufacturing process to print those discs. Less of an issue nowadays, but Nintendo still operates in this fashion because they grew up as cartridge manufacturers. So they actually had to print it. Now, when it comes to publishing, paper game, you know, that timeline can be even longer, right? Because you have to put stuff on, you have to put ink on paper, you have to have it folded, you have to get all the plastic and stuff put in plastic bags and then put into the box and then put into pallets and then shipped from China, usually, over to stores all over the United States so that they're in stores in time for Christmas, and that's like a huge time lag. So that becomes the time limit. Sometimes you just set that time limit because you have to be able to meet ship dates. It's not that very complicated. Now you're working your own internal Kickstarter project or something where you already know who's going to buy your game because they paid for it up front before you even started manufacturing. I think we'll hear about more about that maybe in about 2 weeks, no, about 1 week, April 9th.
length when we can.
Yeah. We'll have a couple of folks who actually work in the board game publishing industry to talk a little bit about how they set goalposts and time and deadlines for themselves. What are the considerations for that? But in the end, it's just they had to set a goal somehow. Either it's a quality goal or it's a time goal. And once you hit that, you have to ship. Because you can always do, if you set a quality goal, you can always do better than that. The more time that you spend, the more, you know, the higher, theoretically, if you are sticking to this, the higher quality your game is going to get. But then if you don't ship, you just have diminishing returns. You'll never be able to move on to your next project. You're never going to get revenue from the project that you started. And your game may not be improved by that much more, just by spending extra time on it. Okay, so again, we're going to talk a little bit about things that are relevant to this thought from what we've observed from assignment one, and then for your team time to today, start talking about what is your culling criteria. You know, what are you trying to achieve with what's the simplest thing that you're trying to achieve with this game? Simplest as in the simplest way to describe it, and then look at all the things in your game based on that criteria. And whatever doesn't meet that might be something that you want to cut out, especially if it's already causing you problems, you know. And maybe it'll just save you time, free up a little bit more time to work on the stuff that's already working. You can polish up a little bit more. Yeah. So any questions about adding and cutting features? Okay.
Yeah. So. Related to taking all this and relating it to assignment one and then going into assignment two, and then also starting with the cut when you cut in assignment one. So when it comes to advanced rules and basic rules, if you're going to do an advanced rule set and a basic rule set, make sure your basic rule set matches the core experience you're trying to make with the game. It's really, really important for assignment two, for this current assignment, because that's what we said when we set out, right? Is we said, come up with something that's going to have a very particular experience that you want the players to have at the end. So if you're going to do advanced rules and basic rules, that criteria should be part of what your basic rules are. The advanced rules, as Philip mentioned, yes, for some of them, it could add more interest, it could be more intellectually stimulating, but really the basic rules should support everything the game has, and the advanced rules are just add-ons. And actually, if you don't want to send us advanced rules, don't just cut it completely. Say we're not gonna use the rules or advanced rules because we just could not get them to work in time, and that's absolutely perfectly fine, so long as those basic rules still match the core experience you're trying to get across.
I think one thing I do want to add to that for the most part, your basic rules were pretty darn good.
Yeah.
Much better than a lot of the advanced rules. Maybe because the wording in the basic rules had a little bit more care. Maybe you tested it. We found the basic games very playable and pretty enjoyable. Was probably just fine for what we were expecting from assignment one. So a lot of the stuff that you had in advanced rules, I do realize some of those were things that came up in the testing process, and you thought, you know, this is the game that our game has evolved into. But once you realize that there is a core basic game that works. And then there's this sort of like slightly more complicated version of the game. That slightly more complicated stuff is all candidates for cutting. Because you've already identified what's the most important stuff, and that's all in your basic rules.
Yeah. When it comes to time and your deadlines, of course, adopt a common lingo, adopt a common language, stick with it, proofread your rules. I think I have it written down at the very bottom, proofread your rules, so I'll say that a third time later on. And that means like naming conventions for the pieces, for what you've chosen to call things in your game. That could be naming conventions based on the rules, but also proofreading your cards too, making sure all your pieces are using the same language. When it comes to talking about what the player does, we did notice some should versus may versus must kind of getting mixed up. So when we're playing the game, we're not quite sure, well, if I should do this, if I may do this, why? Is it, if it's may here, is it also may over here, or is it should over here? Just wasn't quite sure. Wasn't quite clear. So I definitely recommend spending today working on your rules, spending today having us play your game using your current rules, and then taking our feedback and then working on it for turning on Wednesday. And again, when it comes to cutting things, when you are cutting, making sure that you are filling in the gaps. So if you cut something out, there might be a system, there might be a rule. In this case, it generally was polish issues. So if something was removed from one of the rule sets, we saw a little bit of
remnants
of it, like spread in the rules.
So for instance, say you're one of those groups that had basic rules and advanced rules, and you took a chunk of the game and you moved into advanced rules because you realized the core basic game was playable without them, but your basic rules still refer to bits of the advanced rules. And that gets really confusing, because advanced rules are completely different section of your rules that we haven't even gotten to yet when we're reading your rules. So do that cleanup work.
For setup, so if you're going to have a setup section before your rules, it's actually highly recommended. Have a setup section that is split out, that is different from your rules section, so we know exactly how to set up the game. Include diagrams and photos. Where do players sit? What is the orientation of cards? If you have a card that has all this information on it, what is that common information across all cards? If you think about a Magic the Gathering card and all the different icons, hopefully your cards aren't as complex, but you'll have the same thing in the same place on all the cards, so you can then tell us what that thing is and why it's useful and how to use it as we're playing the game. And just in particular, let your game teach us the game, how to play, if possible, if you've got time. If not, it should still be in the rules. What we mean by let your game teach us is if you're going to have a board, the board has a lot of empty space on it, you can put some of your rules into the board. You can put some of the setup features into the board if you've got time right now. Proofread your rules, and turn in as many copies of your rules if you have players in your game. So. The assignment did say it's a set number of 2, 3, or 4 players for your game. If it's a 4-player game, give us 4 copies of your rules. That's all the basic stuff. Yeah. And then we'll be getting your feedback, specific feedback for each individual game, tomorrow.
Yeah,
tomorrow. I'm not sure what time tomorrow, but we'll get you that before you're actually turning in. That's it for me.
I just want to clarify one thing about should, may, must. I'm not sure, because I'm trying to think of a more concrete example. So mm-hmm. So it's like, if in your rules you say the player should move their piece, his or her piece, you know, from one square to another, we're not quite sure whether you're describing this as a good strategy, as something that the player, you know, should generally be doing, because it's going to put the player ahead, or something that the player must be doing because the rules require the player to do this sort of thing. Should is a very, very difficult word to figure out for us. If you're going to be giving... Yeah.
Would you just suggest not using the word should?
If possible. Yeah. I mean, sometimes context explains it for you, but it does muddy things more often than it helps. I find should makes perfect sense if you're going to give an example. If you're going to give an example, make it italicized, make it obvious, or even like
putting it in a sidebar,
like do indents or sidebar or something to make it clear that this is not actually part of the rules. This is an example of how this set of the rules plays out, and then you can use words like should, right? You know, player one should do this because you're describing a strategy. You're not saying that the rules require this to happen. Must say must when it's must. If a player must do something. And when you say a player may, be very, very clear of what else the player may do.
Yeah.
Say, for instance, it's 1 out of 5 different options. You say that the player may do one of these five options, bullet point, bullet point, bullet point, bullet point, bullet point.
Yeah.
You know, and the last bullet point is probably like, do nothing. You know, it's like if your game allows for this sort of thing.
Bullet points are really, really useful if there's any kind of option. If it's just like, player may do this or this, break out the or in its own line, give it bold, put a couple lines around it, put the next thing that they can do, the other thing they can do after it, make it really, really clear it's one or the other, not both.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that goes the same for not just your printer rule sheet, but also current stuff on the board. You know, because sometimes there are games where you have options on the card, right? You may just do this or you may do that. It's not entirely obvious if, say, the card does both of those things, or you get to choose one of those things, and who gets to choose one of those two things. So that's something to keep in mind. You only use numbered bullet points, 1, 2, 3, 4, if something's meant to be sequential. You know, it's good for things like, here are the steps of a round of gameplay. You know, first you do this, then you do this, then you do this. Don't say the player may do one of the following, 1, 2, 3. It's like, now I'm not quite sure what's going on here. Okay.
And actually that just brought up rounds, stages, phases.
Oh, that's the vocabulary thing again.
Yeah. Choose one, stick with it. Yeah. Proofread it, make sure you chose it, make sure it works. Especially if you're gonna make any changes today and you're turning it in 2 days. Have somebody who is not you proofread it and make sure you're using the same language throughout.
Yeah. Rounds usually involves everybody around the table doing one thing in sequence, the same sort of thing in sequence. Steps are really big.
Yeah.
Phases are usually like describing large chunks of game, but you know, things like the opening gambits, mid-game, end-game phases, and usually not used in rules, but I know that some games do
18
that.
18XX games.
Yeah, 18XX use that.
Sometimes phases are recurrent.
I know. This is why it's maddening, because it gets used in both contexts.
So what would you use to describe like the individual pieces of a turn?
I think steps. Especially if it's a sequential sequence of things. Like, this is my turn in a round, and here are the three steps I get to do. You know, I draw, step one, draw a card. Step two, choose a card from my hand. Step three, play it, right? You know, things like that. That sort of works. Phases, I've also heard it described in things like, there is round one is one kind of action, and round two is like a completely different kind of action, and round three is completely different, and there's like phases. And it's like, oh my god, that Power Grid does that, actually. Yeah.
In Agricola, there are turns within phases, within rounds, within stages.
Yes.
Yes. This is why the game is actually so much harder to learn than it is to actually play. To play is actually not that hard.
Yeah.
But when they describe...
The phases don't matter, and the turn is... And everything else is actually reasonably intuitive, so...
Yeah. So that's why phases complicate things. Sometimes it is, in fact, the right word, but it's just hard to be able to convince, to expect that every single player is going to interpret that word the same way. Okay.
So you can break up new teams, continue working on your games. This is playtest time, so in particular, playtest your rules. If you want us to play your rules and give you feedback before you turn in, today's the day to do it.
And attendance sheet?
Attendance sheet's right there.
Attendance sheet's over there.
Yeah.
Please.